Okay, welcome everybody. Tonight is February 24th, 2024. It is the 14th lecture of the French Revolution, and tonight I hope to at least start about talking about Reb Shamson Raphael Hirsch. I just wanted to say, I figured, okay, you know, we'll talk about Reb Hirsch, and like, you know, maybe I'll, you know, have one, maybe I'll try to, you know, stretch it to two. But as I was just learning about and just going through what the material of who he was and the places where he has been, the what he accomplished, and then you start to get into his writings and philosophy. So it's really, there's so much about Reb Shamson Raphael Hirsch. I don't know if I'll actually be able to finish in two or even three sessions. Again, we could always, you know, cut things out, but there's so much about what he has to, what he is and what he was. I guess you say there's an understanding that Hashem, in every generation, Hashem gives the Jewish people leaders, and leaders that really are tailor-made for the times. And Reb Shamson Raphael Hirsch was really one of those leaders. He was there, he was in the middle of it all, and he was just like perfect. He knew how to relate to people. He knew how to fight the reform movement, the secular, the maskilim, everything that was out there. He really waged a polemics war against it all. And to a large degree, he was very successful. He had a tremendous influence on his society, on his time. But even today, a lot of the ways that we live, how we are Jews today in a modern era, a lot of it comes from the vision and the philosophy of Reb Hirsch. I don't think we're going to touch this tonight, but one of the things, I just wanted to say it out in the beginning, one of the things that Reb Hirsch is known for, his philosophy, is something called Torah Im Derech Eretz. Well, they changed it to Mada afterwards. But that was his thing, is Torah Im Derech Eretz. And there's a lot of misunderstanding of what that is. And people take that philosophy and they just, you know, take things out of context and distort it. So maybe we'll see if we can get into it. But it seems that many people they take that Torah in their Acheretz and they permit for themselves or they permit for others a certain lifestyle or a certain way of living in a modern era, which is something that Reb Hirsch did not mean. All right, but that's opening up. Let's just start. There's an essay that Reb Schwab wrote about Reb Hirsch. Now, who was Reb Schwab? Reb Shimon Schwab. He was, he passed away not long ago. He was the Rav of Yeshurun up in the upper Washington Heights. He was a Rav there. Now, if I'm not mistaken, if I got it right, he married the daughter of Reb Breuer. So Reb Breuer was Reb Schwab's father-in-law, and Reb Breuer married the daughter of Reb Shamson Raphael Hirsch. So Reb Breuer was the son-in-law of Reb Shamson Raphael Hirsch. So Reb Schwab's wife was Reb Shamson Raphael Hirsch's granddaughter. Okay, I guess we got that. So he wrote, he was also the Rav of the community. His father-in-law, Reb Breuer, was the Rav of the Washington Heights community, the German Yeki community, as they call it there. beautiful, wonderful community. And this is what Rav Schwab writes. I mean, he has a whole essay. I just opened up. I wanted to open up with this paragraph. Anyone who surveys his life's work, that's Rav Hirsch's life's work, cannot be but amazed at how one individual was able to accomplish so much during a single lifetime. Where did he possibly find the time and energy to write so much, to publish so much, to show such vital leadership? Tens of thousands of pages of his writings exist, done in longhand with nary a correction. Mm. He was responsible for publishing a monthly journal called The Assurant. And of course, there were his classic works on Chumash and Tehillim, Chorev, and we didn't even mention the 19 letters, which was short on a far-ranging far-ranging philosophical issues, all of which are now fortunately available to the English-speaking reader. This prolific output is all the more astounding in light of the fact that many of the printing aids that we have today were not available in his time. I don't know if when Rav Schwab wrote this article, if they had like the computer to write on. He's probably referring to like a typewriter, right. You know, but even the computer now.
Electric typewriter.
Maybe he may have had an electric typewriter. Okay, but we're not available. He had no ghostwriters, no dictaphones. Whatever he wrote was done entirely by himself in longhand. Clearly, we have here a demonstration of what we call siyata dishmaya. For without Hashem's help, he could not have done all this. Now, you'd think he was just a writer, and that's all he did is he locked himself up in a room, and he wrote from morning to evening, he did write from morning to evening, but he was the Rav of many shuls in many areas, and he had communal responsibilities. And we'll see what some of those responsibilities are. Okay, so let's just go on. It wasn't like he wrote in a vacuum with nothing there. He was busy from day to night leading communities. At one point, he was the Rav of the entire, basically, Austria. Like, he was the chief rabbi of Moravia, which had in it over 50,000 Jews, which he was responsible for. And yet, he was able to do what he accomplished. Writing alone was just amazing. All right, his early years, Rich was born in Hamburg in 1808, which was then part of the Napoleonic France. So that was part of, he was born during the time Napoleon was alive, and that was all part of France for the next 5 years or so until Napoleon was taken out. His father, Raphael Aryeh Hirsch, a merchant, owed much time into his studies. His grandfather, Mendel Frankfurter, was the founder of the Talmud Torah schools in Hamburg. So that's also, remember, we spent a number of weeks discussing Hamburg, because that was the first official Reform synagogue. Mm. And it was in the probably 1820s, I believe, is when it opened up. And that's it. He was a young man at the time. I don't know if he was still in Hamburg at the time that it opened up, but the influences were there. So his grandfather opened up a Talmud Torah, and he was an unsalaried assistant, a rabbi of neighboring congregation of Altona. And his granduncle, Yehuda Leib Frankfurter Shapira, was the author of several Sfarim, including Harachasim LeBeka. Okay, so he came from a very prestigious family. I believe his father wanted him to become a businessman. And at 15, we sent him off to be apprenticed, to become into business. And Baruch Hashem for us, Rav Hirsch said, business is not for me. I want to be part of the rabbinate. I mean, how many people rabbinate go to business? But that was him. This is where Hamburg is, north. Here's Frankfurt. These are some of the other cities. Berlin is over here. Okay. Hirsch was a student of Chacham Isaac Barnes. We mentioned Chacham Isaac Barnes last week. Mm. He was in Hamburg. They brought him in order to like blunt the influence of the Reform, because Rabbi Isaac Barnes, he spoke in German, He spoke weekly. He donned the robes of the German priests, and he himself also had gone to university, Reverend Bernays, and he was a he was a gadol. He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. So the Jewish people, even the secular, did not feel that they were missing out on anything, and they did not feel they had to go to the Reform synagogue because they were getting everything plus. They were getting the real deal. So this Rabbi Isaac Bernays was his Rebbe. He was by Rabbi Isaac Bernays. He learned by him. He was also involved a little bit. Rabbi Isaac Bernays, when the second Siddur came out, Hamburg Temple printed a second edition of a Siddur, and they said this is the Siddur for all the Jewish people. Rabbi Isaac Bernays came out very vocally against it, and Rav Shamsul Frohl Hirsch saw this, and he realized, you know, he's going to sort of continue the battles of his Rebbe, Rabbi Isaac Bernays.
I'm just wondering, from the beginning I was wondering about the hair covering for both in the beginning picture of Shamsun and Rafael Hirsch, right? This kind of, I don't know if this is this how film people wore, and then like Rabbi Bernays also has this.
Right, okay, it's interesting. It's like a big, not just a yarmulke, but it's like a skull cap. It's like that covers the entire.
Is that how they?
Okay.
Yeah.
It could be in Germany. That's how they would wear. But at least you see that their head was covered, as opposed to the seculars that wouldn't cover their heads. I think. Okay. In furtherance of his plan, he studied in Talmud Torah from 1828 to 1829 in Mannheim under Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. Yaakov Ettlinger also was a big gadol. Yaakov Ettlinger and Rav Bernays, both of them were students of Rav Bing. Okay, that was Rav Bing was also a big Talmud Chacham, and these two were his students. And Rav Bernays also had the next generation of students, which would have been Rav Hirsch and Rav. His name will come to me. We'll see. But the next generation of Gedolim, were many of them were Rav Isaac Bernays Talmidim. Okay, so he went to Rav Ettlinger. He received smicha from Rav Bernays in 1830. He was by Rav Ettlinger for about 2 years. Came back to Rav Bernays, and at the age of 22, which seems to be very young, he received smicha from Rav Bernays, and then he went to the University of Bonn. Not that he wasn't looking for a university degree, but I guess like his Rebbe, Rav Bernays, he felt it was important to go to the university to get some sort of background. If he's going to have an influence on people that felt that university degree was very important, and that was it, that was like the best education you can get. So he went himself, and to show that, I guess, he was machshavit, and he did gain from it, and that's where he went. But, of course, in the University of Bonn, as, you know, Hashkacha would have it, he met Avram Geiger. At the time, Avram Geiger was still Orthodox, he was still frum. They actually learned together, b'chavrusa, and then that's Avram Geiger is going to go off to the dark side. Avram Geiger is actually going to eventually they're going to come together, because Avram Geiger is going to be the leader in Frankfurt. And he's going to he's going to be so successful, there's not going to be not an Orthodox shul, he gets to close all the mikvahs, no shita, nothing. And eventually there's going to be a few families, or start with 11 families, that got permission not to break off from the Jewish community, and that's, but to have their own society within the Jewish community, and they're going to ask Rev Shamshel Foyle Hirsch, who was the chief rabbi at the time of Moravia, which again, 50,000 Jews, is going to leave that position and become their rabbi in Frankfurt. And in Frankfurt, he's going to be, that's like for 30 some odd years, he's going to be there, and he is going to build up that community, and he's going to, his issues, we're going to see what his issues were with the government, with everything. But that's the end, that's, so he meets, you know, early on, and they, that's how they got to know each other. Okay, in 1830, he goes to one of the cities called Oldenburg. He was elected as chief rabbi. The chief rabbi there went from one place to another and recommended Rav Hirsch to take over. Now, during this period, he wrote his 19 letters on Judaism, which was published under the pseudonym of Ben Uziel at Altona in 1836. Okay, this work has made a profound impression on German Jewish circles because it was something new. A brilliant intellectual presentation of Orthodox Judaism in a classic German, and a fearless, uncompromising defense of all its institutions and ordinances. So what happened is, when he was in Oldenburg was a very small town, and he really did have a lot of free time. And what he did is he ended up writing his commentary on Chumash called Chorev. And he comes to the printers, and he wants to show them his you know, Chorev, could we, you know, print it? And it was like five volumes of the Chorev. We have it today. It's a masterpiece on Chumash. And they were afraid, the printers were afraid to print it because it was a large printing, and they didn't think there was an audience for this work. I mean, again, everybody's being very secular and very, you know, reform, and this is like old traditionalist stuff, and they didn't want to do this. They didn't want to. So what Rav Shamshel Foyle Hirsch did, he says, okay. And what he did is he wrote like a much smaller book, which was called The 19 Letters. He wrote this book in German, clear German, like not Yiddish or anything, polished German. And basically the book was his philosophy. And it starts with, I would like to go into the philosophy of the book. It's very worth it just in a nutshell, the philosophy letter one was a letter by the name of Naftali, when he was a Jewish secular boy or man writing to his rabbi. Ben Uziel. Ben Uziel is his name, his writing, his pen name. But writing to the rabbi, and his question is like, you know, come on, Judaism is over with, it's gone, and like, you know, why do you have to follow the Torah? All it does is makes you miserable, and laws that don't exist anymore, and just so on and so forth. And the next 18 letters is Rev Shamshel Foyle Hirsch's response and his philosophy on Judaism. And he says, before I can stop you off answering this, let's get things clear, like, what is the purpose of life? What's the purpose of a religion? And then as he goes and explains things clearly, all of the questions fall apart. Now these 19 letters made such an impression on German Jewry. It was the book. It was the bestseller. It was a popular book. Anybody who was from had that book. People had memorized parts of it by heart, and it was just just brilliantly written. And now finally gave the Orthodox something that they can fight back with. They had a clear understanding. That book gave you a clear understanding what the purpose of life is and why, what's the orthodoxy and the fallacy and the shallowness of reform. That was the book. Now, the book was also, when it came in terms of mitzvos and everything, it was like his book Chorev was the book that was the, this was like the letters going back, and the rabbis talking about the mitzvahs, and these, this is it. His book, Chorev, it was like a, like, what do you call it? Like a introduction or a, you know, introduction or a, that's the right way when you want to show a little few things, clips of
preview.
The, a preview, thank you. It was a preview of Chorev. And then eventually Chorev came out. This happens to be where Olenburg is, again, in Germany, mm-hmm. north, very very north and west of Germany. Hanover, Hamburg is right near Hamburg. So this is where he was. And this is where he was able to sit and learn during this time. Now, during this time, also another, like, amazing, Hashkafa would have it. And that is, when this book, 19 Letters, came out, it made an impression on a young man by the name of Heinrich Graetz. Graetz. You have this, right? You have this. You have history of the Jews, right? Like, this is what he put out, right? So he was so taken in by the 19 letters, he wrote to Rav Shamshel Feuerl Hirsch. Rav Shamshel Feuerl Hirsch says, "One, so come to Oldenburg, you'll stay by me." So Graetz stayed by Shamshel Feuerl Hirsch for 3 years, almost 3 years, from 1837 to 1840, and he was there as a pupil. And that's it. He lived in Rav Shamshel Feuerl Hirsch's house in Oldenburg. I think
in
Oldenburg, huh? Oh yeah, yeah. So your companion. I think he wrote things for him. He would like write. Write things out. He was. What I wanted to say. I don't have it here, but he writes a description of Shamshel Feuerl Hirsch's schedule during the day. And I was trying to find it, I couldn't find it, but he says Hirsch would open his day, start his day at 4 a.m. in the morning. And basically he'd be sitting and learning, and he would write late into the night, and finally, that's it. That was his schedule. From 4 a.m. in the morning, his day would start, and he was busy with whatever he was doing, but constantly writing and constantly learning. And this is when he was able to get a lot of his learning and the philosophy and his ideas, Hashkafa, that's where he had it in the 5 years that he was in Oldenburg. What ended up happening is, again, Graetz went off. He also went to the dark side. But he went, I don't know if he went to the, if you get shades of dark, it's all dark by us. He ended up with Frankel, with the conservative. So he ended up becoming a teacher for Frankel, which is somebody we should also at some point have to discuss. But Frankel is probably what we would call the father of conservative Judaism. And Frankel himself, he looked like a rabbi. He had a beard and payas, but he was an apikaris. And his, whatever his philosophy was, Graetz felt more bound to that. So the book comes out, History of the Jews. And if you could see, it's like, what, it's a 6-7 volume book. It was the book that came out. And among the members of Frankel's staff, this is, was the infamous Heinrich Graetz, who was a history professor in the seminary. By the time Graetz had published A History of the Jews, which offered the notion, again, this is conservatism, that the development of the halacha had been dependent on different temperaments in various ages. If you had a guy that, you know, just had always had an upset stomach, so he's always going to be very machmer. And if you had a guy that, you know, was a chilled out guy, he's always going to be makel. I mean, that's like Narishkeit. By the way of example, he cited, now, by the way of example, just one small example, in Graetz, cited Rabbi Gamliel, who was known to be strict. Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, who was known to be rigid in his opinions. Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania, whom Graetz called a moderating force. According to Gretz, the personalities of the Rabbanim was the factor that determined whether the views of Hillel and Shammai were accepted. Thus, in Gretz's view, the entire Mishnah is nothing but a listing of political debates between warring factions, each of which has its own axe to grind. I mean, it's a chaval. But this is what they put out, and this is what people believe. Because they took a look at their own rabbis, and they see that's what they see in their modern, you know, professors and rabbis. So that's the way it always was. You know, it's the way it is in Germany in the 1830s, and that's probably the way it was in the 830s or the 30s. You know, like that's how they viewed it. So when Hirsch read the history of the Jews, he knew he could not let it pass without a response. In fact, Hirsch regrets. He'd been one of Hirsch's earliest students. When Hirsch wrote the 19 letters in Oldenburg, Gretz had been in his house as a student. However, this one-time disciple had turned sour, and now Hirsch considered it his sacred duty to present his response. In a very systematic way, Hirsch took each section of Gretz's book and shredded it to bits, using logic and traditional sources as his weapons. He revealed Gretz's methodology as being astoundingly unscientific, showing how Gretz had taken Talmudic quotes totally out of context and had built misleading theses on this basis. In the process of demolishing Gretz's position, this could be also part of Schwab's essay. So I believe this is part of Schwab's essay writing. In the process of demolishing Gretz's position, Hirsch revealed his own phenomenal bikias. In one instance, while disproving one statement Gretz had made about Rebbe Elazar ben Hyrcanus, Hirsch cited no fewer than 60 different proofs, all based on texts throughout Chas. The wide range of his knowledge is remarkable. Today, we have Google, you know, we have databases, computers. However, in Hirsch's time, such information was not readily available. Someone who can quote so extensively from Mishnah, Gemara, Tosefta, and Baraisa had to be, without a doubt, a certible Talmud Chacham. Hirsch used his brilliance to defend the forces of tradition against the attacks of Gretz and his ilk. This indeed was Hirsch the warrior. So he was just, I guess you look at his responses and you see how he quotes the Gemara and everything. It's just, how do you know all this? Where do you get everything from? You know? Yeah?
What is the Bikias?
Bikias, there's two ways in learning. There's something called Bikias and something called Ian. When you learn in depth, that's called Ian. You're learning in depth. Bikias is you learn not so much in depth, but your breath. You know, like Dafyomi, for many people would be Bikias, right? Some people it's their Ian.
You're
skimming the surface. You want to, you know, so when you say he had a tremendous bikias, it means he knew so many different sources.
Okay.
In the same, he was still in Oldenburg. So after that became a big hit, he went back to the printers and said, hey, okay, let's do Chorev now.
Why did he use a pseudonym?
Huh?
Why did he use a pseudonym?
That's a great question. He probably, I'm guessing is, he didn't want to be personally attacked by all of them, which they did once they knew who he was. That could be one reason. He didn't need a personal, you know, because the way they responded was attacking him, not so much his philosophy. Also, it could be is that he didn't want, you know, if people knew him as to be an Orthodox Jew, whoever it was, from, you know, like, they'll say, he's biased. Mm-hmm. So if you can separate the ideas from the person, I'm guessing that's maybe why he put them out. Okay, and you're going to see throughout his career, often he would put out essays and different responses, tshuvos, and publicly write things that were not his name, and other times he would. I think probably as he went later on in his career, they all knew it was him. In 1838, Hirsch published as a necessary kind of commitment to the letters of his Chorev. Again, really, this was really the product. This is what he wanted to come out with.
Right.
As a textbook for Judaism for educating Jewish youth. Now what happened is, in Oldenburg, and also in the next, in his next, this could have been already in, after Oldenburg, he was in, it wasn't Nikolsburg, we'll see, it was in, okay, no, it's still in Oldenburg. So in Oldenburg, he wanted to open schools. It was always, for him to open schools is very, very important. To the point is where he's going to leave Moravia because they were giving him a hard time about opening up a school. So he wanted to open up a school in Oldenburg. Problem is it's hard for him to find rebbeim, teachers. The schools he's going to open is going to have Jewish studies, the Torah, Gemara, and everything. And then also it's going to have secular studies also. So to find people to teach Gemara and, you know, proper philosophy, proper Chumash and Navi and etc., there were no, he couldn't find anybody, and he also couldn't find source material to give them so they could teach from. So he wrote it. He made source material, and that was what Choriv was. That was one of the things that Choriv was supposed to be, like a textbook, so that people, you know, teachers could look in it and teach the youth, you know, they could teach themselves also. Another thing in 1839 again in Oldenburg. Now we mentioned last time when they came out with a sitter, right? The Hamburg community, the temple, came out with a second sitter. And basically what they did when they came out with a second sitter, they got so many different rabbis, modern rabbis, to write reasons why it's a good thing and it's positive. And I guess in response to Rabbi Isaac Barnes saying it's usher to use the sitter and everything, they came out with this book. The book was called, I'm taking a guess here, I can't, I'm telling you right now, Wissenschaftlich Zeitschrift für Judistische, okay, whatever. It was, huh? It is German. It's written in German, and it wasn't, everything was German about it. And it was to promote the sitter that the Hamburg Temple came out. So in 1839, here also, he published it, not in his own name. The person, again, is Naftali, a polemic essay against the Reform Judaism proposed by Geiger and the contributions to this sitter. So that was his philosophy. I guess, again, here, he didn't want, it's not about him, it's about the sitter. So, you know, he published anonymously, okay, so deal with this, is this right or wrong? Nothing to do with me. So maybe that's why he did it anonymously. Okay, this is a reprint, of course, but this is the what Geiger came out with in 1835 about his religious, you know, philosophy, and this is Hirsch's response to this book. Okay, there was another book that came out in 1844, a different type of book also, which is attacking Holtheim. Holtheim was another big reformist in that time. And he came out with his book, and Rev Schwab came out with a book on Samuel Holtheim's book. Okay, these are like pamphlets, essays, responding why they're wrong. Okay, from there, he now moves to Emden. Okay, that's his second step. Now, again, in Oldenburg's very, very small. He had a very few amount of responsibilities or few amount of families that he was in charge. And now he moves to Emden. Now in Emden he finds himself very busy. And he's restructuring everything. He wants to get schools going. And because that's really what saves Klal Yisrael, saves Jews, Yiddishkeit is the schools. And you have good yeshivas, and that's what he was in wherever he went. Okay, Hirsch remained in Oldenburg until 1841. He was elected chief rabbi of the Hanoverian districts of Aurich and Osnabrück, with his residence in Emden. During his five-year post, he was taken up almost completely by communal work, had little time for writing. He did, however, find a secondary school with a curriculum featuring both Jewish studies and secular program. That's why his Jewish studies were not watered down at all. And it didn't, you know, at all, like you know, into the times, and we have to water things down, do things differently. His Jewish studies were pure Jewish studies. He also had with it, like today's yeshivas, you know, you have in the morning, it's Gemara, whatever, or regular learning, in the afternoon you have secular studies. That's more like what Hirsch did, and I think that's mainly what Hirsch meant with Torah im Derech Eretz. Not that the Torah itself becomes like secularized or watered down. For the first time employing his motto, Torah im Derech Eretz. Okay. This is where Emden is. Again, northwest. This is, you see Emden in the big map of Germany. It is on the border, the north, very north and west corner of Germany. He was in charge of Arach, Osnabrück, I'm sure areas in between as well. It was a very poor area. And he had more families he was responsible for in Emden than he did in Augsburg. Did it say Augsburg over? Oldenburg is over here. So he had more responsibilities, as you can see, and it kept him busy. And now he was busy, he didn't have as much time in writing and learning as he did before. Okay, in 1843, he applied to be the chief rabbi of England. Now, it says over here, chief rabbi of the British Empire. Now, I don't know what that means. I mean, because the British Empire in 1843, the sun never set on Union Jack, right? So does that mean, you know, he can go around the world and he's the rabbi of every single British? It could have been a political position. It could have been just in Great Britain itself, or it could have been, so, but he didn't win it. He lost out, and that wasn't, it didn't come to him. But in 1846, he was called to the rabbinate of Nikolsburg in Moravia, and in 1847, he became the chief rabbi of Moravia and Austrian Silesia. This is where Nikolsburg is. I'm not sure how large of an area, but again, it encompassed about 50,000 Jews. I just want, huh?
Is Moravia a country?
No, Moravia was an area inside Austria. The country at the time was Prussia, Austria. I'm not sure exactly how it was called, but it was definitely part, it was an Austria part, or was it called Prussia at the time? Things are going to change now. Just I want you to keep in mind the year 1847. Okay, we're not probably looking at the time. I'm probably going to want to end early because of next door. But the in 1848 is going to be maybe we'll get to it, the Second French Revolution. Mm. And that Second French Revolution, 1848, is going to spark probably about 50 revolutions all over Europe. Everybody's going to want to be free. And now there's no Napoleon to blame it on. Right now it's a people's thing, and everybody's going to have to deal with it, including Prussia. And we're going to see, this is what Rav Hirsch is going to be get involved in this as well, in terms of emancipation, especially for the Jews. Okay. So here we have his inaugural address of Rav Hirsch. Now, what happened is Rav Hirsch came from Germany. In Moravia, the Jews are mostly still traditional. They're still dressing very, very traditional, not modern. And the ideas of reform are starting to come more east, but the rabbinate, there's plenty of houses of learning, there's yeshivas there, and everything is, you know, they're very, very wary. They see what's happening in Germany. And all of a sudden, now you have this German rabbi, Rav Hirsch, looking different. You know, I don't know if he put on the priest robes when he spoke, but he was more clean cut. He had a different look to him. He dressed differently. And they were very, very nervous in Nicholsburg. What are they getting? Are they getting a closet reformer? He's going to come in and he's going to make everything reform. And therefore, you know, the most of the community still that were very, very frum and did not follow reform, they were very, very nervous about Rev Hirsch. To make matters worse, when in his inauguration, it was a Rev Mannheim. Now, we touched on Rev Mannheim before. Rev Mannheim, in his earlier days, he was older now, he was one of the original reformers, reform rabbis, maskilim, and he was friends with all of them. It seems that as he got older, he mellowed out a bit. But he had a shul in Moravia. I believe that they did play a organ on Shabbos by a goy. But that was pretty much the extent of it. He didn't radicalize the davening. It seems that he more mellowed out or became more towards traditional as he got older. And this Mannheim introduced Rev Hirsch. So you could imagine if they weren't nervous until now, now this Rev Mannheim is getting up and they all knew him as a reformer. And he's getting up and he's, you know, giving his, you know, introduction and his positive, you know, on Rav Hirsch. So we had this was his speech. This is Rav Hirsch's speech. Chief Rabbi Moravia Rav Hirsch mounted the steps, and this is, we have this, somebody wrote all this down as, you know, they recorded this. Rav Hirsch mounted the steps leading to the Aron Kodesh and began with the remarks of the verse. Wealth and honor comes from you, and you rule everything. He continued, true honor comes only from Hashem, and to whom does the king of the world wish to give honor and respect more than to Talmidei Chachamim? I'm sorry, did I skip? Does the king of the world honor and respect more than to Talmidei Chachamim who learn Torah and keep his mitzvahs and go in his ways? Hashem wants to give honor and cover to Talmidei Chachamim. In passionate tones, he described how he was but dust under the feet of these Torah scholars, and he promised the assembled rabbis that he would defer to them and stand by them at all times. So he's saying everything the right thing. In tears, he said, "What am I? Who am I to sit in the place where such distinguished succession of great men have sat before me? Maral Meprag was one of the rebbeim here." Was a rub here, and all through the generations. He was just many, very, very, it was a very chashuv rabbinate that was here. Now, also conspicuously absent from his remark was the slightest mention of Mannheimer, whom normally protocol would have required that he thank. Mannheimer bore his humiliation in silence. After rehearsing his remarks, from Naftali Benay of Shafa, I believe he is the son of Rav Mordechai Benet, I don't know how to say his name, which was a very, very chashuv rav as well. He was the one that, the first time when the Hamburg synagogue came out with a siddur, they collected a whole bunch of rabbis. Rav Benay was one of those that wrote. His son now, eldest of the Rabbanim present and son of Rabbi Mordechai Benay, ascended the podium and gave an effusive thanks for the heartfelt words that he just heard. Addressing Rav Hirsch, he promised on his behalf and on behalf of the members of the elder generation of Rabbanim present to assist him whenever he would request it. Mm. He apologized on their behalf for having assumed that their chief rabbi would turn out to be like many other German rabbis who did not fully sympathize with the older generation. Now they realize their mistake, he said, and in their name he asked for forgiveness. It made a stirring sight, Rav Hirsch weeping because they had suspected him, and the Rabbanim weeping over their mistrust of him. You know, it's reminded of this of the scene every was the in the second base of Mikdash before Yom Kippur. So at that point, the Tzedukim, there were many Kohanim who would Tzedukim. The office, the position of the Kohen Gadol was sold to the highest bidder by the Romans. They had control of the, and they sold it. They sold to the highest bidder. Many sometimes you had the tzedukim that took the position. Tzedukim, they only believed in the Torah Shabbat Pan, not the Torah Shabbat Sabbath. So what they did is the Erev Yom Kippur, the week before Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol would move into the Beis HaMikdash, and from day to night, they would teach him things and how to do, what to do and how to do things. Sometimes they didn't have to because he was a Kohen Gadol, he knew what to do. I mean, he was a Haredi, like, you know. But so other times, you had a guy who was just an Am Haaretz. He was just, you know, rich, and he bought the position. Now they have to teach him. So after all said and done, Rabbanim would take the Kohen Gadol and they would make him swear that he's not going to change from anything that the rabbis told him. And he would swear. And the same, this is the way he's written here, the same, the Mishnah is bring down the same scene. The rabbis would cry that the Kohen Gadol would cry that he was suspected of being a tzaduki. And the rabbis would cry because they had suspected that he was a tzaduki. So like the same scene over here played out. Okay, I think we're going to end here because we're going to now next time we're going to get more into what happens in Nicholsburg. In the OCE spent 5 years reorganizing Jewish congregations and instruction of numerous disciples. He was in charge of all yeshivas, and he was in charge of what they're learning. And he was also, in his official capacity, chief rabbi, a member of the Moravian Landtag, I guess part of the parliament, where he campaigned for more civil rights for the Jews in Moravia. We're going to start next time with the Second French Revolution, which was in 1848. And what happened as it came to Austria, Prussia, Vienna, and what happened there, and what happened to the Jews, and how Rev Hirsch was fighting for the Jewish causes. So that's already, you know, this Europe is going to make another, you know, turmoil and tumult, you know, after Napoleon. 30 years later, it's going to happen again, and it's all going to affect the Jews. This is now Hashem's way of bringing all the issues in Germany to in Central Europe. Okay, so Mr. Shem will pick this up. We'll pick this up next week. Thank you for coming out. Next week may be the last week. We'll let you know if it's the last week or the second last week.
Okay, so next week, remember, we're going to start at 8:00.